Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
Portrait of a nervous man, Oliver Pope by name. Office manager by profession. A man beset by life's problems, his job, his salary, the competition to get ahead. Obviously, Mr. Pope's mind is not on his driving.
I'm a friend of the family's. Could you tell me, how is the boy? Yes. Terrible.
Arrested that hit-and-run driver, Lil.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, but is that any reason for you to look white as a ghost?
The man they arrested was Pete Radcliffe.
Oh, I don't believe that.
Here, read for yourself. Positively identified by an eyewitness at the scene of the accident.
I still can't believe it.
Search for tenderness, it isn't hard to find. You can have the love you need to live. But if you look for truthfulness, you might just as well be blind. It always seems to be so hard to give.
And mostly what I
from you.
Open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination, and you're invited along. We'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone. And I am here today with my co-hosts, Robert, Bobby, and Dave. Hello, guys. How are you today?
Howdy.
Fine, thanks.
Hello, good. Everybody. And yes, we're honest and upfront with our reviews, just to let you all know out there. Hello.
Yes, and we also have our always special guest here, Rick Wall. And we haven't even more special guests. I'm sorry, Rick, but this person hardly ever comes in here. We have Sunny. Hi, Sunny. Good to see you today. There's hardly anybody more special than Rick, but when Sunny hardly ever comes in. So we gotta give her props today. Hello, Sunny. So
hello, Sunny. Long time no see. Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah, it's been a long time. So,
well, you know what, Lynn? We better be careful today. Bobby might hit and run us with his review.
That's true.
See, everybody's waiting for you, Bobby.
<Ba-da-ba-boop>. Okay, well, on this rather gloomy day here in Pennsylvania, we had a gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful week all week, sunny and outstandingly mild and just like in the 70s, it was wonderful. And today it's gray and gloomy and yucky. So maybe that's kind of a perfect setting for a story like this, which is also kind of dark and gloomy and depressing. But it's called You Drive. And I'm going to turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Oliver Pope, businessman turned killer on a rain-soaked street in the early evening of just another day during just another drive home from the office. The victim, a kid on a bicycle, lying injured near death. But Mr. Pope hasn't time for the victim. His only concern is for himself. Oliver Pope, hit-and-run driver, just arrived at a crossroad in his life, and he's chosen the wrong turn. The hit occurred in the world he knows, but the run will lead him straight into the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it certainly did lead him into the Twilight Zone. This one's called You Drive, and it stars Edward Andrews. And basic premise, we have a gentleman named Oliver Pope, and he's in a big hurry. He's very nervous, and he's distracted, and his mind's not on his driving. And as a result, he slams his 1956 Ford Fairlane into Timmy Danvers, who was a young boy, about 10 years old, I guess, delivering newspapers on a bicycle. What are you laughing at?
Well, he was supposed to be 12, but he looked about 15 to me. I don't know where you get 8 from.
Oh,
then,
oh, oh, oh. 10. I said 10.
He was supposed to be 12.
Oh, was he 12? All right. 12 to 15 years old. He's about 12 to 15 years old. And he was...
Maybe she was thinking about his grandfather that was, maybe it's passed on from family to family.
Well, actually, Dave's right. He did look older than 12, to be honest. You know, I didn't know. I mean, I'm figuring back then, you know, they would say somebody was in her 20s and she looked like she was in her 40s, you know. They always look older back then. But anyway, you know, the kid's delivering newspapers, and he's on his bicycle, and he hits him, and he injures him seriously, and seriously enough that the boy eventually dies from his injuries. So Oliver stops, but then instead of helping the boy and trying to revive him or take him somewhere, he just hurries off. He gets in his car, flies off, and he tries to conceal the fact that he was involved in this accident and all. And then his wife, his poor wife, Lillian, and his coworkers, they notice that he's becoming increasingly irritable, very, very annoying. And then one of his coworkers, a guy named Peter Radcliffe, he is inaccurately identified by a witness as being the one who hit the boy. And Oliver does everything he can to encourage that erroneous suspicion. And then before long, Oliver's car seems to take on a mind of its own. It starts to rebel against Oliver. When Oliver's near the car, it honks its horn, it flashes its light, it attempts to start on its own, drops its bumper. Oh, it tries to close the hood on him, and it repeats the radio news flash of the boy's death in an attempt to get Oliver's attention. Then, this is a good one, while his wife is driving the car, it drives to the scene of the accident and it stalls out. It's determined to get Pope, Oliver Pope, to admit his guilt in the accident. Well, eventually Oliver says, you know, I'm not driving this car anymore. He decides to walk to work so that the car isn't seen by the police. But the car decides to leave Pope's garage on its own, chases him down the street in a rainstorm, and seems to be about to run him over, but then it stops just before doing this. The passenger door opens. Oliver turns around, gets in the car, and the car proceeds to drive him to the police station, where he does eventually walk in to confess. Ha! Okay, well, we're getting close to the middle of season 5 here, and there have been good episodes, and there have been lousy episodes. And as far as I'm concerned, this one falls somewhere in between. It's not terrific, but it's not terrible. I mean, it had some really good scenes, but it also had some slow moments. And you have a guy with a lot on his mind, runs into a kid on a bike with his car. He gets out, looks at the kid, and then flees the scene. Okay, well, I'm sure that happens even, you know, nowadays. You know, people just, I'm sure that happens all the time. People just don't want to take responsibility, so they leave. But immediately, his paranoia and his guilt and his cowardice set in. He can't bring himself to admit what he's done. Now, on the other hand, the car has a different point of view. The car's saying, man up, admit your guilt, Oliver, turn yourself in. I mean, that's what his automobile is trying to tell him by tormenting him relentlessly. And
well,
I
then for this show, we'll name the car Chester.
Chester. Poor Chester, you know. Chester's like, I don't wanna be the bad guy here. You did it. You drove me into the kid, you know. Poor Chester. And so, you know, Chester's trying to get him to do the right thing. And I felt sorry. I don't know if anyone else did, but I sure felt sorry for his wife Lillian, because she had no idea. She had no idea what he'd done. And she was basically clueless, and he would not confide in her. He just kept snapping at her. Come on, if you can't be honest and tell your spouse what's going on, then there's no hope for you.
Honesty.
Oh, my God. I mean, I felt bad. It was all up to his car, all up to that piece of metal to bring him to justice. And the only thing I felt that Rod's opening narration, kind of a bit of a spoiler when he described Pope as a businessman turned killer, because you don't find out the kid's dead until the middle of the episode. You know, so he kind of spoiled that, but that's right. I excuse Rod. I always excuse Rod for those things because he's Rod. And enough said there. Rod can do it every once. But, you know, and you have to wonder what's making the car do the things that it's doing, don't we? I mean, was it Oliver Pope's overpowering guilt giving the car a will of its own? Was it the spirit of the dead boy? Now, that would have been the creepier explanation and the most appropriate for the Twilight Zone, you know, just having the boy's spirit inhabit the car. But I don't know. They never really tell you. But it reminded me of the scene in season 2's episode, the thing about machines. He had that cranky, obnoxious guy, Bartley Finchley, and he meets his death when his own automobile chases him down and chases him into his pool where he drowns. Okay, that it reminded me of that. So
you know, when his razor chases him, it must be serious then.
That's right.
Going down steps.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And, well, you know, guilt has played a role in more than a few of those episodes. I mean, we had 30 Fathom Grave, The Arrival. We've had episodes where guilt played, you know, a part in that. But, or a part in the ending where the person, you know, died. But anyway, Edward Andrews, I thought he did a good job of playing the guilt-ridden Oliver Pope, and he also played the nosy snake of a guy in Third from the Sun from season 1. But all in all, I thought it was a decent episode. It wasn't outstanding, but I didn't have too many problems with it. And so I'm giving it 2.5. Over to you, Robert.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. Yeah, I give this story pretty much an average myself. I just wonder if this was kind of the root idea for Stephen King later on for he did, which was Christine.
Sonny, you ever owned a car before?
No. I just got my license.
Start her up. Her name's Christine.
I like that.
I saw you guys at the football game. How'd you ever get that car fixed up like that?
Oh, just plain old-fashioned hard work, huh?
Ever since he bought that car, he's been obsessed with it. And you know what else? They told us the man who owned that car last died in it.
What do you know about that car?
I know that the guy who owned the car before Arnie, his daughter choked to death in Christine.
That car. I swear it's the car.
How's Christine coming?
Oh, Cherry.
That's funny, you know, because I heard she was total.
Well, after I cleaned up the broken glass, it wasn't so bad.
So what if you fix it up, you know, and he just comes back and does it again?
He won't do it again.
And the Maximum Overdrive movies that he did.
Hi. My name is Stephen King. I've written several motion pictures, but I want to tell you about a movie called Maximum Overdrive, which is the first one I've directed.
Wow.
What in the dickens is going on around here?
A lot of people have directed Stephen King novels and stories. And I finally decided if you want something done right, you ought to do it yourself.
And who was driving it?
I don't know.
Curtis! It's coming after us!
It was my first picture as a director. And you know something? I sort of enjoyed it. I just wanted someone to do Stephen King right.
You want a war? You got one.
I just want to get the hell out of here.
So come and spend some time with me and my friends at the Dixie Boy. Spend some time in the dark.
Please don't let me in the dark.
No! Help me.
I'm going to scare the hell out of you. That's a promise.
You're going to get us in an awful lot of trouble, man.
We already in trouble.
Maximum Terror.
Jesus coming and he is.
Maximum King.
Maybe tomorrow will be our world again.
Dino De Laurentiis presents Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive.
I wonder if he had the idea for that. I call Christine a car with an evil soul. There was 2 points that I wanted to bring up where the accident happened. There was a telephone booth right there. Why couldn't he anonymously call to a coward at least call in and say, hey, you know, there was an accident, boy's hurt, you know, send an ambulance or whatever. Why, you know, I don't know why he didn't call for help. Also, the running lady, she must have a foggy memory. Why couldn't she remember his license plate on the car? Because you notice later on, his another guy gets framed. I guess he got framed because his car was similar to what he was driving. And the scene where Oliver's wife was driving the car and the police was trying to start the stall car. Couldn't we, don't we have it on the police blotter or written down that there was an accident with this type car? Shouldn't we take a look at the bumper of the car? I mean, there had been some damage done to at least rouse some suspicion. It just seems like this story was this stupidity rule in this story, unfortunately. I mean, the episode was watchable, I agree with that. But it just seemed the people weren't very smart in this episode. It'd be quite honest.
You know how many cars there were of the same type and the same color in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah. Everything was black, brown, or white.
Yeah. And, you know, the police might have had a description of a car.
Yeah.
That's it.
I agree.
Well, I mean, I just think they could have checked. Wouldn't there have been some kind of blood or something from the boy when the car hit him?
Didn't he fix the headlight and whatnot?
Well, I think towards the end, he smashed the headlights.
No, he didn't try to fix anything. He tried to destroy it.
Yeah, and this symbol, the horn, when the horn was going off.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it cause more suspicion, too? Or it goes out with broken headlights. Horn constantly going off. I'm just saying, there are just some... signs, and I agree with you, Rick. Yeah, there were many different colors and many different cars. It probably would have been hard for them to spot it, but I mean, come on, it just seems, you know, a lot of these people weren't very clever in this episode. And I know if it's just writing or what it was, but I mean, it's for us to judge how we felt about.
I couldn't believe he didn't tell his wife anything. You'd think if anybody, you'd just tell your wife what happened and see if she can work through it somehow. But, you know, he didn't want to tell her at all. It was just weird.
Well, I mean, it's like Rick said. You can definitely tell this was a morality episode.
Right, yeah. He didn't want her to know that he was a coward, that he didn't want to own up to what he'd done.
And I guess the boy did die in the episode because when he made that
call. Did.
Yeah. So. Anyway. Give it a 2 out of 5. I give it pretty much an average.
Okay.
And head over there to Bobby. Bobby.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think Robert said it best in his review when he called it stupid. But it's not stupidity on the part of the characters in the story. It's stupidity on the part of the writer. I mean, Earl Hamner Jr. wrote 8 episodes of The Twilight Zone, most of them in this final season. And some of them weren't too bad. They were bearable. I thought The Hunt was the best one he wrote. And we recently did Ring a Ding Girl, and that was bearable. That wasn't bad.
Which one?
But this episode is absolutely ridiculous.
Which one did you just mention? Which one did you mention that wasn't bad?
The Hunt.
And there was
another guy with the doll?
Yeah, but then you said a second one.
Ring a Ding Girl.
Oh, okay.
What's that too?
Right.
Anyway, Earl Hamner Jr. is still with us. He turned 91 years old in July. And he could probably write a better story at 91 than he did when he was 41. Because this story is simply full of holes. It's got holes everywhere. The premise isn't bad, at least for that time. This premise has been done 100 times since then. Well, it wasn't so bad for considering 50 years ago. But there's just, I mean, I can only repeat some of the things I said in my written review. And you can start out with the fact that you can't possibly run into anybody and not have any damage to your car. It's simply absurd. Is it a car or is it a tank? It's ridiculous. I mean, it takes very little to damage your car. You can damage your car while you're parking. So the idea that he hit a kid on a bike and he killed him and there's no damage to the car is simply preposterous. It's just not believable at all. It's absurd.
Bobby, I agree with you, but I think the cars back then were a lot heavier and built better than they are today. So
yeah, but there's got to be something. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, really. So anyway, there's so much inconsistency in the story. For instance, if this car can now have a mind of its own and take him to the police station to turn himself in, then why didn't the car avoid hitting the kid? Why, at the critical moment, didn't the car not swerve out of the way? It certainly didn't seem to have a conscience back then. Now all of a sudden it does. If it swerved out of the way, we wouldn't have a story to begin with. So, you know, there's a lot of inconsistency right there. And basically, it's the same old story. I mean, even though it's absolute heresy to mention this story with a classic like Living Doll, it's almost the same kind of story. It's about an inanimate object that tries to right a wrong. I mean, in that case, it was trying to stop child abuse. And in this case, it's trying to get a guilty party, somebody guilty of manslaughter, turn himself in. It's almost the same kind of story, but obviously they don't belong in the same room together. There's no question about that. I also find it strange that I would take on the police here. I mean, where are they? Are they looking for him at all? I mean, his wife takes a car out and is stopped by a cop. And they're not even looking for the car. I mean, he has nothing to worry about. A child has been killed, and there isn't an all-points bulletin out for this car. I mean, when you run into somebody, if you do a hit-and-run accident, even if nobody sees you, the biggest problem you'll have is that there's damage to the car. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to hide it somewhere? Are you going to drive it off a cliff? If you take it into a body shop to get it fixed, they'll probably know that there is a lookout for a car with damage to one side or the other. But then when you write a story that the car doesn't have any damage, I guess you don't have to worry about that. I just think that Earl Hamner Jr. wrote a ridiculous story here. If he had written The Waltons like this, it never would have been a hit series. Nobody would have watched it. There's too many holes in it. Now, in my written review, I mentioned the fact that since there is a witness, why didn't she write down the driver's license number? But I was wrong about that because I went to several websites before the show about hit-and-run drivers, are they usually caught? And when they are caught, how are they caught? And writing down the license number won't do you any good. Because if you get caught and you've got any kind of lawyer at all, he's going to simply say, where's the proof that my client was driving the car? I mean, you can't put the car in jail. So he could easily say, sorry, he wasn't driving the car. And unless you have somebody there who says, yep, that's the guy I saw behind the wheel, it really won't do you any good. You've got to have positive proof when you do that. Now, also at the Internet Movie Database, at least one poster over there mentioned a lot of inconsistency in this episode. And this doesn't come from me because I don't watch things that carefully that I would notice about this. But somebody wrote, anyone notice the bloopers while in the garage, the front bumper falls off, but when the car backs out of the garage, the bumper is on the car. Also, while in the garage, he breaks both headlights out, but when driving down the street in one scene, only one light is broken, then both are broken. Also, the front bumper in one scene is missing, and in another, it's there. So whoever was doing continuity on this episode must have taken a day off, because there's all kinds of ridiculous things going on in the story. It's not impossible to watch it. I watched it again today before the show. And, you know, you can watch it. But, you know, as long as you put your brain on hold and don't hold it to anything that makes any sense. And all I can say is I can't imagine that you could run into somebody or anything without having some damage to the car. But I understand why Earl Hamner would write it that way, because if you do write it the way I'm saying, you haven't got a story. I mean, he'll get caught right away, and that'll be it. Somebody also said at IMDb that it would have been a better story if it was fleshed out to an hour, which is just laughable. I mean, honestly, that's all I need to do is have to sit through an hour of this nonsense. So we've still got two stories coming. I mean, almost at the end of the series, and we've got two stories by Earl Hamner coming up. One's not so bad, and one closes out the series and is absolutely dreadful. So he was all over the place, and it's almost when you look at the list of the stories he wrote, it's almost like they turned the series over to him. I mean, he's doing a lot of writing at the end of the series, and this could have been a halfway decent story. And it also kind of poops out at the end. It's not very exciting. I don't know that I needed the car to run over him, although it would have been justified. But to have a car simply pull up to the police station and he meekly walks out of it and he goes in to turn himself in is kind of weak. I mean, he's a coward, and now all of a sudden he's just going to go turn himself in. It's not consistent with the way he is at the beginning when he simply leaves the kid there to die. So I give Ava 1.5. Just, I'm not sure exactly why. I can see 1.5 or 2 for this episode, but I can't see much beyond that. It's just got way, way, way too many holes in it. So 1.5, Lynn.
Okay. All right, Dave.
Okay. Let me just remind people. First aired 3rd of January 1964, Series 5, Episode 134. You drive. I can't really fight the corner of this one too much. The story was fairly light, and I think it definitely could have the script could have been tidied up and improved on, as Bobby said. I mean, first of all, I was taken straight out of it when I thought as a young teenager, he looked about 16 to me on the bike. Probably could have been a 14 because I know some. You know, you can never tell with children. They can look 5 years older than they are.
Especially back then.
But when they said 12, I nearly fell off my chair. I thought, no way. I mean, this kid was, you know, junior high at least. So I didn't particularly like that. Now, the main actor, Edward Andrews. Now, I've seen him on a lot of things. I think he was in Dick Van Dyke Show or something like that. A very familiar face. He's on lots of stuff. But I thought his acting was a little bit hit and miss. I thought on some of the scenes in the house he was fine. But his reactions with the car to me seemed very amateurish. I mean, to show anxiousness, he kept touching his chin. And he seems to use the same expression about 4 times. They did him no service, by the way, in the opening bit where he's driving along in the car, because they only showed him driving in the car twice, and it was the same bit of film each time, with him driving, looking back, driving, which seems strange. I agree, it does seem weird. I mean, the boy gets knocked over right in front of a telephone box. Now, you could argue that the fella panicked, but you think he would have, you know, dashed into the phone, dial 911, you know, wipe the phone handset or whatever, and then beat a retreat. It was very difficult as a viewer to have sympathy with him when he'd left the boy like that. So there was none of this. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but sometimes when you're watching these programs, you're almost rooting for the person to get away with it. Like if they rob a bank or something, you're almost rooting for to get away with it. Think, you know, somebody actually is going to, you know, not going to get caught and trapped. But when he was so callous with that boy, there's no way you can be rooting for him. You really
right.
want him to be found
right.
out. Where if he'd at least gone into the phone booth, made a call and thought, well, at least somebody's coming to his aid. All I want to do, I don't want the lad to die, but I don't want to take the blame. Then we have the situation where, as we said, the car starts going wrong. His wife, right? His wife is an ideal witness to him. She hears he explains to her, well, perhaps the electrics are wrong, or this, that, and the other. Even the wife drives it to the garage and so on. So he could blame the car. I mean, he could say, well, I lost control of the car. I was in the car, but I wasn't in control of the car. The car's mechanics went wrong. Ask the garage. We took it there, and it disappeared. So he could have used that excuse.
Yeah, he could have said the wheel turned as he was turning the corner or something like that. And went on
locked,
there.
Yeah. Locked her, yeah, whatever. I liked, again, like what Bobby said at the end. I mean, what they could have done at the end with the thing is, and I'm going back to what you said, Lynn. I mean, it was given away at the beginning that the boy got killed, because you said. Now, if we'd have had the all the way through, the boy had died. I know when, because I thought when he actually rang the hospital, about 8 o'clock at night, he rings the hospital to find out how the boy is. I thought his reaction was then that the boy had died. But it's only with the paper the next morning or something we found out the boy's died. Well, maybe we could have had the boy died when he rang up on the phone. Then we could have made more sense of the final scene outside the police station when, as he's going into the police station, you hear the newspaper's boys, or the newspaper boys possessed the car, you know, and said, you know, serves you right or something. If it had some scene right at the beginning where, let's say, this newspaper boy, I know in America they just chuck the newspapers on your front lawn, don't they? So maybe if it had had a scene at the beginning where this newspaper boy always tries to hit the bloke on the head with his newspaper or something and shouts, watch you, mister, or something like that. And then at the end, when the car drops him off at the police station and he's walking in, the car goes, watch you, mister, watch you, mister. You know, so I don't know, perhaps that would have been too silly. What else? The continuity errors. I didn't know this, but reading the wiki page, apparently somebody said that the accident was on, was it Park and Vine or something, and then they said Park and Valley or something at another point. So definitely Bobby's
third
right there.
Third
and Elm and Third and Pine, yeah. So they gave that difference.
Thanks, Danny.
Yeah, so to me, this script, they were obviously getting towards the end of the series. That script needed a rewrite. It needed two rewrites. It needed polishing. And as I say, that lead actor, although I do like him as an actor, I think he's a very likeable person. It's difficult to have sympathy for him. And I thought some of his reactions in the garage didn't play out well to me. So I can't really say I thought his acting was consistent. So I'm going to undercut some guys here. I'm going to give it just... I can't undercut Bobby. I've never undercut Bobby, but I'm going to give it a 2 rather than, I think Robert said 2.5, Lynn. So just a straight 2 from me is... It was...
Yeah, I said 2 also. It's
I gave it 2.5. Okay, well, cool. Thank you, Dave. Rick?
Anybody ever hear of somebody by the name of Kitty Genovese?
No.
Mm-mm.
Okay, in the 70s, a woman was killed on top of a roof in New York City. 30,000 people at least heard her cries for help and cries as she was being, I believe she was stabbed. I forget exactly if she was stabbed.
You're talking about Kitty Genovese.
Yeah. Nobody called the police. Not one person dialed 911.
This was when, in the 70s?
I'd say about
this is back in the 60s or the 50s, late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, 60s.
Wow. I never heard of them. Yeah.
Not one person called the police. They received nothing.
I don't want to get involved situation.
Right. Okay.
It's like somebody else to do it.
Right. I liked this episode. Was it boring in parts? Yeah. Were there continuity problems? Yeah, but I don't blame the script. I blame the person who was supposed to be, if they even had a continuity person, doing it, and the director.
Rick, can I just ask, the thing you said at the beginning, how does that relate to this story?
She didn't call the cops.
No, but a witness did.
30.
Yeah.
You had at least 30. Can I talk, Dave?
Go on.
You had your bit. Thank you.
Go ahead.
As I said, I blame the director and the continuity person for the holes. The acting was all right. I'd give it a two and a half.
But let me explain why I was jumping in there, Rick Walks. I'm sorry to talk over you, and I think somebody's already put it in text. There's been a few delays with the sound on different people. But I've never yet known of a murderer phoning in to tell the police, but there was a witness, and the witness did call the police. But your reference was to an event where nobody called the police. In this story, there was only one witness.
Who
she called the police?
Who cares? The person who was responsible didn't call. Same difference.
You mean the person responsible for Genevieve's murder?
No, the character. I forget his name now.
Oliver Pope. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The perpetrator doesn't often phone the police, surely.
No. Yeah. Well, no. Yeah. The person is doing it certainly won't call, no.
Well, the killer won't unless the killer has guilt, and then they'll call it in anonymous.
But the witness in this did. That's why I was not understanding the reference to the real-world event.
Unless there were no witnesses. I mean, there were people who heard the screams. As Rick said, people heard the screams, and I suppose you could call them witnesses in the sense they heard it. And see it, but they heard it, so I guess you could say that none of the hearing witnesses called in. Yeah. Which, you know, it's a shame that you could have that many people hear something so disturbing and not even make a move.
Oh, you know, it is absolutely disturbing. I just didn't know how it related to this story.
Yeah.
It seems to be a theme that if you watch a lot of these detective shows like Rockford Files or Canon, Barnaby Jones, you know, you can name them, where someone gets framed for the situation and then they have to go and find the actual killers, Perry Mason, to find out, you know, this is what was going to happen here. I mean, if the guy didn't have so much of a guilt complex, he could have got away with it by just not saying nothing at all. It was
exactly.
The car that was, you know, aching him to go to the police and confess all. But technically, if the car wasn't acting that way, he could have got away with that by just staying silent.
Exactly.
Nothing. And the other guy would have got framed and went to prison for
what he
did. So.
Well, Sonny here is saying that she recalls a movie being made about that thing that you brought up, Rick, about Genevieve's. She recalls a movie. Do you recall anything like that?
Yeah. I believe it was a TV movie.
She recalls.
Actually, I believe there were a couple.
Really?
Yeah. You know. And also, what Bobby was saying about eyewitnesses. When I was in college and taking one of my psych courses, they had I took a legal psych course for some reason, but people would come in. Yeah, he was a tall, short, fat guy, skinny, bald, had blonde hair,
black hair, scar on the face, whatever. Yeah.
So, eyewitnesses catching people or criminals are very unreliable.
Well, Sonny also says that she finds it hard to believe that in that day when women were mostly home, you know, most of them were not working women, some of their noses weren't stuck out of the curtains and they didn't see anything.
I mean, at least we did have a reference to that in terms of the motorbike cop when the woman identified, when they're watching the spot to see if the killer, quote-unquote killer, would come back to the scene. And she sees him and she says, that looks like him. And he said, I'm sorry, ma'am, that isn't good enough. and she said, yes, that's definitely him. She misidentified him, so that makes Rick Wall's point quite good, in as much as that, you know, it was definitely a different man, but she, at that great distance, was still, you know, so keen
right.
to be helpful that he said, yeah, no, that's him, that's him.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true. It's just, you know, it's just amazing me that anybody, you know, could hit somebody, especially a child, and just walk away from the crime. And
by the way, I just went to IMDb, and the History Channel is going to have a movie on soon called Silent Witnesses, the Kitty Genovese murder.
Get out of here, really?
It's right in front of me. It hasn't aired yet. It doesn't say what the date will be.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a TV movie. It's already been done, but they don't have a date set. It's on the History Channel.
Wow. Hey, Rick, I mean, talk about coincidence. Oh, that's amazing.
I'm a psycho. I mean psychic. Yes,
how
I was right the first time.
A little bit of both, baby. Oh, cool.
Yeah, she was the victim, and the guy that killed her, his name was Winston Mosley. I believe it was in the 50s, I'm pretty sure.
I think it was a little later than that. I think more
yeah,
like
I think,
60s.
Wow, Winston Mosley. Sounds like a murderer, yeah. That's cool. No, actually, Winston Mosley sounds like somebody who would be a millionaire. Millionaire mogul Winston Mosley, yes. Not a murderer. Wow. Oh, that's cool. I'll have to keep on top of that and see when it is. All right. So
you know what's interesting, Lynn? We did have a hit and run here, I think last week, and it wasn't involving a boy.
Where
what happened?
Live? Where do you live?
Yeah, where I live out here in Ohio, Columbus. There was a woman driving a truck or driving a car. She was veering off from a 4x4 she hit, and the guy that was working at this one place, and he got hit and got pinned underneath the car, and he died. And then she, I guess just under frustration, or I don't know, he didn't want to be car or whatever, she walked away from the car, and one of the guys made a remark about the car was still running, and she said, turn it off yourself. And she lived, I think, like a block or two away from home or something like that, and they caught her before she got home. People were
yeah.
calling
oh my God.
And calling it in. So, yeah, the guy died. But
pretty stupid, huh?
Yeah, that's what I said. There's people still around that are like that. So.
Wow. That is pretty stupid. Oh, Sonny, what do you give it? Give me your rating on this. Because I gave it 2.5. And Robert gave it 2. Mm-hmm. And Dave, you gave it what?
2.
2. And Rick?
I agree with you.
2.5. And Bobby, what was yours?
1.5.
1.5. And Sonny gives it 2.5. Okay, so 2.5's win. Okay. Mm-hmm. Got a majority of 2.5.
I brought up the article from the New York Times about the real life murder. It was March 13th, 1964.
All right, okay. I thought
he was 28 years old, and there were something like 30 some witnesses who didn't. 37 people watched and didn't call the police.
Wow.
And a lot more heard it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. Wow. How old was he?
She was 28.
Oh, she was 28.
I don't know. It doesn't say here how old he is.
Huh.
He was found guilty and sentenced to death, so. But he got life in prison. I don't know if he's still alive or not. Yeah, he's currently still in jail, yeah.
He's Bubba's girlfriend now. Oh, well. Okay, well, we finished up with this episode. All right, and the next episode will be
Long Morrow.
The Long Morrow, that's right, starring Robert Lansing and Mariette Hartley. And, will be 2 weeks from now on September 27th, Saturday, September 27th. Robert Lansing and the lovely Mariette Hartley in The Long Morrow. So I
enjoy Robert Lansing as an actor. He was pretty good in that Star Trek episode with Terry Garr.
He was a very good actor, yeah.
Yeah, he played Gary Seven in that Star Trek
episode. The one with the cat.
Yep, the black cat.
Isis.
Well, wasn't Mariette Hartley also in that episode? That, or not that episode, but in that series?
Don't she might have made an appearance in the original Star Trek. I'm not for sure.
Mariette Hartley was in the Star Trek, but I don't know which series. I mean, I don't know which, you know, version.
Mm-hmm.
But so there was that connection there. Okay. Yeah, well, that's going to be in a couple of weeks. And you better all be here. Don't make me have to come and get you. Make me have to drive you by your toes to the show. And Sonny, I want to see you again. I'm so glad to see you here. You know, you don't come around often enough. So,
yeah,
Sonny,
thank you for making it in.
Yeah,
she's in Star Trek All Our Yesterdays, penultimate.
Okay. Mariette Hartley?
Yeah.
No, oh, Robert Land. Oh, you're talking about Mariette Hartley. Okay.
Yeah. Mariette Hartley, yeah. All right, so Sonny, I hope I see. Well, don't forget about the time. I know the time difference. That stinks. Yeah. Well,
oh, she also did the Porteroy commercial with James Gardner too, didn't she? Mary Hartley, didn't she do Porteroy commercials with James Gardner?
I don't know.
I think back in the 70s or 80s, something like
that. That sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. I want to see you here, Sonny. I want to see Rick. I want to see everybody that's here today back in 2 weeks. Hey, Rick!
Yes?
What happened to Disneyland? Wait, you're back. You're not.
I didn't go yet.
Oh, that's right. Just joined me. You weren't even supposed to be here. You're supposed to be in Disney World, Disneyland, whatever.
I didn't go yet.
My God!
I know.
Well, today, Rick, you were our guest.
Yeah, well, we'd rather have you here than there. But,
be our guest.
Well, wait, was it Disneyland or Disney World?
Land.
All right, well, damn. This is, what, the fourth time you were supposed to go?
Yeah. Long story, I'll tell you on the after show.
Okay. Oh, damn. Okay. Well, I'm glad you were here. All right. So, everybody, see you in 2 weeks. Adios, amigos.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Might just as well be blind. It always seems to be so hard to give. Honesty is such a lonely word. Everyone is so untrue. Honesty from you. I can always find someone to say they sympathize. if I wear my heart out on my sleeve. But I don't want some pretty face to tell me pretty lies. All I want is someone